What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review on this very first weekend of 2026. And we're going to take a look at the top stories making headlines across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, Palau's president is defending a new deal he's just signed with the U.S. to resettle 75 deportees. The U.S. has classified kava as a food, opening the door for exporters from across the region. And we take a look at how a Pacific entry took the lead and almost won the Sydney to Hobart yacht race. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, we start in Papua New Guinea, where a 12-day Christmas cruise came to a sudden halt last Saturday when the Australian-flagged Coral Adventurer ran aground in Papua New Guinea waters. 80 passengers and 43 crew would spend the next 4 days stranded on top of a reef after numerous attempts to refloat the ship were unsuccessful. They were finally evacuated, taken by a local ferry to the closest port, and flown home on a chartered flight. While there were no injuries or serious damage to the vessel, it's the second major incident involving the same ship. The Coral Adventurer was at the center of a media storm in October when it left an elderly passenger behind during an island tour. Investigations into that incident are continuing, and so too is a new maritime probe by Australian and PNG authorities on the grounding. Ben Carey is the head of Papua New Guinea Search and Rescue Coordination Centre, and he told the ABC that the Coral Adventurer is being detained until investigations can be completed.
The Coral Adventurer was salvaged yesterday afternoon also at about 6:30. She's been towed out of the reef and now is at anchor at Dreghaf and waiting for her next move, whether to go to Madang or come into Lae. She has been detained by NMSA, by the authority, to go through all the investigations, and then after that, whatever happens, we will advise the owners. But the owners are aware, they've got a detention order already from NMSA. We're working closely with the ship owners, the company, and also with AMSA Australia.
And that was Ben Carey. He's the head of Papua New Guinea's Search and Rescue Coordination Centre. And Palau's president, Surangul Whips Jr., has defended a deal he's just signed with the U.S. to resettle 75 deportees in his country. Mr. Whips says the third country nationals who'll be living and working in Palau are not criminals but skilled workers who can boost the nation's workforce. In return, the U.S. State Department says Palau is receiving $15 million in new funding for support services, infrastructure, and a new hospital. But the president is rejecting claims that he acted alone to sign the deal. He says a working group made up of chiefs, women leaders and political leaders backed the agreement before he signed off on it.
We had a meeting with the U.S. ambassador here in Palau in July. He was brought to the meeting. There was lots of questions asked. And the main concern, because there was agreement in front of us, was there was a lot of uncertainties. For example, we had seen that other countries that accept had accepted these people, and they had criminal records, for example. That was one of the issues that Palau was very concerned about. We didn't want any criminals coming to Palau. We didn't want to detain the people. We wanted them to be able to work. We wanted to be able to stay here. So these were issues that we had to work out with the United States to make sure that we were clear on who we would be accepting. The suggestion was made that there would be a working group. Now, in the working group, we have not only members of the Council of Chiefs, we have members of the Women's Council, We have the members of the Senate, members of the House, a representative of the governors, and a representative of the state speakers. The only group that had no participation in the working group, because the president of the Senate decided he didn't want to send anybody because he was opposed. Not all senators, some of the senators. So he refused to send any representative.
And with the working group, was it a unanimous approval to move ahead with the MOUs, or was there any opposition within the working group to moving ahead?
Well, the working group were all present at the signing, except there was no representative from the Senate. And we went through the process. I think one of the things that we wanted to do from the very beginning was be as transparent as possible. I mean, there's rumors that people are already applied. There's nobody here yet. The process is very straightforward. Once we have the MOU, the next process is the United States will send us a list. We will choose 10 people from that list. They will come. We have them coming, and, you know, they will stay at the college, on campus at the college in the dormitory. And they have basically 60 days to find employment, and that will be the process.
This particular deal includes millions of dollars for infrastructure, pensions, for the hospital. And the U.S. is Palau's biggest donor. Was it possible for Palau to say no to this deal?
Oh, absolutely. And we can even say no now. The agreement is very clear. At any time, if we want to stop, we can stop. But like I said from the beginning, it's about partnership. And this is an opportunity for us to help our closest friend and ally. In fact, we actually say we're even more than that. We're family. When it comes to the security protection of the United States, we are part of the homeland.
One of the stories, anecdotes that's often brought up around this is back in 2009, Palau had a similar scheme. There were Uyghur deportees from the US that came to Palau. That caused tension. It didn't work, and they had left by 2015. How would this be any different to that sort of system?
Those people that came before, those were Uyghurs who were caught in Afghanistan and brought to Guantanamo. The people that we're talking about are third country nationals. So these people have been living in the United States anywhere from a year to 20 years or 30 years. So they've been living in the United States for a very long time. They speak English. They are not criminals. So they were not held in prison. They weren't terrorists. So it's a very different scenario. And those Uyghurs, when they came to Palau, did not come and work. They didn't speak English, for example. So one of the things that we're making sure is that these people have skills, whether they're healthcare workers or they're teachers or they're construction workers or somebody that's working in a hotel or a restaurant. They can be any of those fields. When they come, we expect them to be able to work. I think the impression is that these people are somehow bad people. I want you to understand that they're third country nationals that have been living in the United States, and their biggest challenge has been they can't return home because there's some kind of harm's way that they'll be put into. So because they're unable to return home, they've been allowed to work in the United States. U.S. policy, current U.S. policy is to say, well, we can send them elsewhere, but it has to be to a safe place, just to make sure that really everybody that's coming into the United States is coming in the right way. That's their goal. So I think the idea that we're getting these band of criminals that are come here and destroy Palau is really unfair. These are good people. They have been working. They're hardworking people. They only want a good life, and they want a safe life. And I think that's what Palau can offer these people.
That was Palau's president, Sir Angel Whips Jr., speaking there to the ABC's Jordan Fennell about the new deal he's just signed to resettle 75 deportees from the U.S. in his country. You're listening to Pacific Review on ABC. I'm Evan Wasuka, bringing you a roundup of the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Now to some good news for kava growers in the Pacific. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has confirmed that kava is classified as a food under federal law. Before this recent classification, kava in the U.S. was sold as a dietary supplement. Pacific Island communities and kava businesses say the confirmation recognizes the cultural significance of kava and creates a clearer, more consistent framework for regulation and inspections. Michael Luze is a former chairman of the Vanuatu Kava Farmers Association, and he told the ABC that the latest classification is a win for the region's kava growers.
It is something that we have all been waiting for quite a long time, because it will place kava like as a food. That means we will not have, it will be way more easier in terms of development of the industry in the US. The announcement actually is not a full FDA announcement. It's extract from various communication with the FDA. So it is great. It will give confidence to a lot of the kava bars in the U.S. or any investors in the kava industry in the U.S., well, to sell kava and kava beverage and to serve kava. We are still waiting for more official sort of statements, to be honest with you.
How is kava perceived in the U.S. at the moment, from what you can tell?
Well, it's very unknown. And that's the main issue. Like, it's a sort of a blur sort of thing. Like, we recently we have seen the health authorities in various states shutting down some kava bars because they were mixing kava with juices or things like this. Saw that in California recently. So having the federal government, like the FDA, the highest authorities making a statement like this will definitely be a great thing, like showing that kava should be treated like a normal food product.
You said earlier that kava growers like yourself, exporters, have been waiting a very long time for this sort of clarity to happen in the US. What sort of problems or issues has it caused for kava exporters in the Pacific as they've been waiting for this kind of clarity in the US?
Well, some of the American states have recognized the safety of kava. Like, I'm talking about Hawaii and Michigan. They both have recognized kava as being grass, which means are generally recognized as safe. That means, like many product of the daily consumption sort of thing. And we were thinking that it will be all the states to follow this example. But if the FDA make a statement similarly, it will be way easier for the state or health authorities to just align with the FDA's policy. And that's the issue, because, you know, like, if you are in a state somewhere in the US, the health authorities will have very little understanding about what kava is. So they will just follow what they found online or things like this. And sometimes some of the things you find online are not great. And, well, it's causing issues. So if the federal government is stepping in, well, it will allow more development for kava bars.
And from an exporter's point of view in the Pacific, how significant is this clarity in terms of what impact do you think it might have in terms of demand and prices for kava from the Pacific?
Well, you know, like, from my perspective, it's always good when what we have been saying for years, like, about safety of kava, is getting on the public space. Like, we all have been saying this for years and years. So when it's finally recognized, and it has been recognized by Codex, by WHO reports, and to a lesser extent, of course, in Australia recently with the opening of the market. So, yeah, it is always great, because this is the most significant plant we have in the region, not only from a cultural point of perspective, but also from an economic perspective. Like, we've got very little alternative agricultural product, and we wanted to know that's a reality, that it will be very hard to change simply because we are limited by land constraints cyclones, logistic. We are far away from all the markets. So there's not many commodities where which we can compete with Southeast Asia or with big agricultural producers in Central America, for example. So kava is really a chance. And of course, when we are hearing that kava is dangerous and things like this, which we know is not true, of course it's not good. We don't like it. And so having this sort of recognition by authorities is a great step ahead for us. And we want, well, we would like a more official sort of announcement at some stages, of course, which will happen.
That was Vanuatu kava exporter Michael Luze, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Jordan Fennell. The Sydney to Hobart is one of the world's toughest yacht races. Every Boxing Day, the best sailors line up for the challenge. New Caledonian yacht BNC surprised everyone this year by crossing the finish line with the overall lead. But the yacht was relegated to second place after a rival protested over the crew using a pole to secure its sail. Despite this, Neville Coop from the Fiji Yachting Association says it's still a big moment for the Pacific yacht racing. Despite this, Neville Coop from Fiji's Yachting Association says it's still a big moment for Pacific yacht racing. He says it's the French territories like New Caledonia who are making their mark on the sport.
It's an Australian-built boat, but the designer of this particular yacht is a fellow called Jean-Pierre Kelbert, who is French originally. That, I think, is where the association comes with the team from New Caledonia, who have done really well in this event. It was noted in the presentation earlier, this is the first time a double-hander has won. It's a real effort and endurance race, really, for when you have two people. You can only one person sleeps, the other person's on deck, and sometimes when you need them, they're both on deck, but nobody, there's never a situation where both people are asleep. So 3 days and 21 hours is a long time to keep that up, especially in the demanding physical conditions on a small boat in the open sea. So well done to them. And this boat has been around for a little while. It's sailed under previous names. It's currently called BNC. It's sponsored by Banque Nouvelle de Calédonie, and that's the association with the name.
Is it unusual for a Pacific-based yacht to take the lead in the Sydney to Hobart?
Yachting in the Pacific is quite popular. We have had a lot of sailors from the Pacific compete in Olympic events and major world championships. Here in Fiji, we have a couple of sailors who were in Tokyo in 2024. And Samoa, Cook Islands, Papua New Guinea have also been very much involved, but they've been mainly in the smaller classes of yachts, the sort of dinghy style that are sort of off the beach and sail for a few hours and then are back on the terra firma. But in terms of ocean racing like this, there's not a lot going on in terms of actual racing in the Pacific, but we do have the Auckland to Noumea race. We've previously had the Auckland to Suva race and Auckland to Tonga races. A lot of ocean racing is confined mainly to New Caledonia and French Polynesia, mainly because of the fact that it is so expensive and it relies on sailors who have access to both the funds and the boats, and they are mainly in the French territories and Tahiti. So ocean racing, not so much going on in the Pacific, but certainly a lot of young sailors in the region that are getting sort of prominence worldwide, and we hope that some of them in the future will have a chance to take part in these big events in the not too distant future.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And just with this New Caledonian boat in the lead, what I understand is that there has been a points complaint against BNC. Are you able to explain that complaint and maybe what's the latest?
Yeah, so look, what I've seen is that It's basically what you would call a protest by another competitor for a rule infringement. It doesn't go into much detail as to what that infringement is, but it is from another yacht involved in the race and in the same division, so competing for the same spot, like athletics, for example, in swimming, there are rules and regulations, and protests can be lodged if somebody is deemed to have broken or breached a rule.
And that was Neville Coop, Fiji Yachting Administrator. And BNC were indeed penalised for using a pole to hitch their sail. Unfortunately, it cost them the lead for the Sydney to Hobart race. 17 years after he left to pursue a professional soccer career, Fiji's most famous player, Roy Krishna, has come home to play for Bulla FC in the OFC Pro League, which kicks off later this month. The national captain first turned professional in New Zealand with Wellington Phoenix, and then he went on to feature for four different sides in the Indian Super League. But now, Krishna not only has the chance to play professionally for a team from his own country, but he'll also put a smile on his four-year-old daughter's face by spending more time with her.
As a young kid growing in a football environment, you always wanted to play for a professional club. And, you know, after so long, these things has come up. And, yeah, I'm just lucky enough that I got the opportunity. And, of course, it all depends on the coach. I spoke to him. He was the one who said, you tick all the boxes, in my opinion, and I want you. So, yeah, everything for places. But I'm just happy to be home. And, of course, excited to play for my home club.
It sounds like you didn't take much persuading then to join Bulla. FC?
No, because for me, I've been away from family for a while, and just to come home, I just finished my season in India, and then I just needed a few weeks to just relax with my little one. She's growing very fast, but speaking to my family, I think it was more my little one that made the decision a bit easier, because she said that I want you around all the time. So I'm just happy to be here, and I'm just excited that, you know, we have a professional club, and I'm just happy for our local boys, because this is a great platform for them to play professional and, of course, to do well and then get a bigger club in a professional environment.
What do you think of the way that the competition has been set up? You will know as well as anybody the difficulties of playing in the Pacific and the logistics of getting teams from A to B, be they club sides or international sides. Do you think this is the best model that the Pro League has got?
For me personally, yes, I think this is a great platform, especially, you know, because I didn't know how the game's going to be held. I thought we were going to be traveling every week. But the way they came up with the plan, I think it suits all the countries really well to adapt and to train and to play. But yeah, I think whatever it is, we just need to go with it, because for us, Oceania players, this is a great opportunity. You know, no matter how it comes, we just wanted to play professional, have a taste of it. And I think the first season for every club will be challenging. But at the same time, you know, it's a privilege to play professional.
And the squad, what I'm seeing is essentially the best of what Fiji has to offer. In essence, this is almost an international side, Bulla FC, isn't it? But with some overseas players coming in as well.
Yes, I think if you look at all the Oceania clubs, most of them have their international players. So, yeah, it's a national team. But, you know, with few overseas players, you know, the experience they bring, it's a lot to learn for our boys, a lot to take on board. Because in professional environment, there's a lot of things you need to learn, and we need to learn faster because it's just 2 weeks away before the first game. So the training is very intense, and the boys are already complaining about the endurance running. So, you know, I just told them, this is professional. This is, you know, what needs to be done to play at the high level. But the boys are enjoying it.
So picking up on that last point, it seems to me you have a very significant role to play here in exactly the way you've just described it, saying to these players, some of whom are quite young, that this is what being a professional is all about. You've just got to get on with it if you want to make progress in your career.
Yes, Richard, I think I've learned a lot, especially when I was in Wellington Phoenix, when I first signed. You know, I got a lot of help from our captain, Durante, and then when I went to India, you know, the style, the training style, you know, different way of training. You know, all the experience I've gained, now I come back. These Fijian boys are struggling, but I told them, you know, this is just the start. You know, it's all in your mind. You know, if you think positively, if you just keep going, you know, this will, you know, improve you in when you play the first match. If you run a lot, if you do endurance, endurance, if you sleep well, if you eat right, this thing will improve you as a player. And then not just a player, as a team too. So whatever experience I've gained from abroad, now I'm trying to put on these local boys, especially, you know, the Fijian boys, to do well.
And that's Roy Krishna. He's set to show his Fijian teammates at Bulle FC what it means to be a professional soccer player. And Bulle FC takes on Vanuatu United at the OFC Pro League on January the 17th. And Roy was talking there to the ABC's Richard Ewart. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your time and your company. Do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.